Move to the second case this morning, Henry Radcliffe. Counsel, we're ready to hear from you. You didn't bring your own audience with you, did you?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. No, I did not. My apologies. May it please the Court, my name is Kent Seprek. I'm here on behalf of the Appellant Pension Fund. This is a tail wags the dog case, I think. The tail here is the finding of a violation of the bankruptcy stay. I think that's the minor issue here. The dog is the broader ruling on the meaning of the anti-assignment clause in ERISA. And we have two fundamental problems with the ruling of the district court and the bankruptcy court before that. First, the basic underlying holding on ERISA is that 29 U.S.C. Section 1056(d)(4) is the exclusive means of recovering a debt due the pension plan by an offset against benefits. That conflicts with this court's ruling in Northcutt.
But I'm going to stop you right there because I am. Okay. Did the personal guarantee that Radcliffe signed include a right to offset pension benefits to obtain that reimbursement?
No, but the plan document does, Your Honor.
But wasn't there that kind of contractual right in Northcutt?
It was in the plan document, as I recall, Your Honor, as opposed to the separate subrogation agreement. It may be in the subrogation agreement as well, but the core of the ruling is that the plan document can create the contract.
Why wouldn't the fund just go to the bankruptcy court to seek relief from the stay?
Ideally, we should have done that, Your Honor.
Absolutely.
We did go that way. Candidly, we didn't understand Mr. Radcliffe's argument. The only feedback we were getting was on the mutuality issue, which made no sense. We were honestly concerned about attorney fees adding to the judgment, which only makes these kind of cases worse. We didn't manage to do it informally. Yes, we should have done something more beyond filing an answer that said lift the stay. We should have filed the motion timely, immediately perhaps. The problem is, when you think about it, we don't know who we were supposed to file against and why. Did we file under 362A7 against the trustee? Did we file against the debtor? Did we wait for Mr. Radcliffe to file an ERISA appeal if he was actually going to pursue a claim under ERISA or under the plan? It's at most a meaningless.
Well, I don't think you had to file until he actually made a claim under the plan. But once he made a claim, it would seem that would be a logical time to go to the bankruptcy court and say, we lift the stay because we think we have a right to set off anything that he's...
I agree, Your Honor. And candidly, we were trying informal discussion. It didn't work. We filed our answer in December. We talked with the bankruptcy judge. When they still wanted a formal motion, we filed the motion. It got consolidated. The same thing that would have happened in December. As far as the delay is concerned, if you look in the record, you'll find Nissan didn't file until 4 months after the discharge. So I don't think delay is really the issue here. If I can get back to our basic real problem is not so much whether we should improve our bankruptcy filings. It's that if Section D4 is exclusive, we have no means of recovering benefit overpayments. The district court goes on about how the IRS rules that benefit recovery by offset is okay, but there's no basis for that if Section D4 is exclusive. I think the recent Supreme Court decision in Kennedy versus DuPont Pension put most of the district court and bankruptcy court holding on ERISA to rest. We have two rulings there. One is that ERISA's anti-assignment rule is based on the common law of trusts, and even in a spendthrift trust, you can offset debts due the plan by a fiduciary against his benefits as a beneficiary. That's clear. That comes from DuPont. It comes then from Coar and Crawford.
Here, simplistically, my problem has been that you have not pointed to any, well, International has not pointed to any provision in its personal guarantee of the pension debt which would allow the plan to collect the amount through an offset.
In the guarantee as such, I believe that's the case, Your Honor. The provision is explicitly in the plan, however. And the courts in the past have not found that to be. I agree that that's an issue in Northcutt here, in the Seventh Circuit. Elsewhere, the principle has been more the common law of trusts in which the debt can be offset.
I know, but we're here.
I agree, Your Honor. But the point of Northcutt is still that you can offset benefit overpayments, and if Section D4 is exclusive, Northcutt falls.
Even though Judge Kaney was on the panel?
Even though Judge Kaney was on the panel.
See, you're saying we had a similar provision here in the plan?
Yes, Your Honor.
But not
in the separate personal guarantee.
But not in the personal guarantee.
That's correct, as far as I know, Your Honor.
And you're basically saying that because it's in the plan, that's okay.
Yes, Your Honor. Commonly, that's the only issue. That's the only document we have in any case involving benefit overpayments. If somebody fails to tell us that he's recovered from disability for a year, the only document we have from him is the plan document. If somebody wants to change his election of a joint and survivor annuity within the 6 months he's allowed to, the only provision we have is the plan. If I can just briefly touch on the bankruptcy issues before I run into my rebuttal time. The basic claim here, and the only claim pled here, was the lack of mutuality. That's gone by the board. There's no case law to favor plaintiff. Bankruptcy court and district court also tossed out 362A7, the only issue that involves offsets. Mr. Radcliffe was granted a discharge, that stay provision expired. At that point, Mr. Radcliffe should have gone forward with an ERISA suit. The offset was no longer stayed. He had a viable ERISA suit that he never filed. You can't take the leverage of the benefit fund's mandatory determination letter and convert that into a violation of 362A6. It violates Strumpf, which says that you can't use the stay to force a creditor to pay debts that are potentially subject to an offset. It's not a threatening letter, it's a benefit determination. And the delay alone in the filing of a procedural, a formal motion, as opposed to the answer in December, is not enough to turn that into a threat that violates Strumpf. Basic issue is we have no stay violation. The stay violation couldn't give us a remedy that would allow him to get out of his underlying debt. That's clear from this court's decisions in ALO and Carlson. If I can, Your Honor, if there are no immediate further questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
I'd like to ask you this. Even if the bankruptcy court had determined that the offset was proper under ERISA law, would that mean that the court was required to grant that discretionary relief?
I believe it would be an abuse of discretion not to, because there's no effect on other creditors, which is the uniform ruling.
May it please the court, counsel Brian Woodward, on behalf of the debtor appellee Barry Radcliffe. It seems to me, Your Honors, that this multifaceted case can be distilled into two very simple and distinct issues. Number one, was there a violation of the stay? And number two, was International entitled to relief from that stay? I think the answer to the first question, was there a violation, is clearly yes. Both parties agree, I believe, that this case is governed by Strumpf, each of which discussed those in their brief. And I think telltale in Strumpf is the issue presented. And it was presented as this: whether the creditor, in this case International, of a debtor, Barry Radcliffe, in a bankruptcy may, in order to protect its set-off rights — that's not to set off, but to protect its set-off rights — temporarily, and I emphasize temporarily, withhold payment of a debt that it owes to the debtor in bankruptcy without violating the automatic stay. Now, most importantly, in Strumpf, that creditor filed its motion for relief just 5 days after the bankruptcy stay was imposed. Here we have, I think it's about a seven-month lag time before the request for relief was filed. I want to say it's
six.
Okay, I stand corrected. 6 months. At any rate, it's not near 5 days. I know that 362A7 was abandoned by the bankruptcy court, and I think by the parties. But in essence, what we had here was a de facto set-off. So we're not going to go that route. I think 362A6 is still the avenue that we have to proceed down. But to say that there was not a stay violation is simply not true. The record's clear that the only reason that the motion for relief from the stay was eventually filed was at the urging and prompting of the bankruptcy court. And I think the bankruptcy court, Judge Klingenberger, eventually said, look, file your motion for relief, at which point they did. If you read their correspondence that they denominate as just something that's required under ERISA law, it goes much further than that. They say, this is what we're going to do, and this is what you're required to do. We are going to offset, and we're going to do it unless you contest this. If you don't contest it, it's going to be final, not appealable, and you are not going to receive any benefits unless you do this.
Now, what bothers me about this case is his company is delinquent and making its contributions to the pension fund. To get over that, he signs a personal guarantee that he doesn't live up to. And when all is said and done, he walks out of here with, among other things, $10,000 in punitive damages. That just doesn't seem quite right. I'm not saying that it's necessarily wrong, but it doesn't strike me as necessarily the right
outcome. At first blush, it may not seem right. But it seems to me, on a deeper level, it is entirely the correct decision. That is, the whole purpose of bankruptcy is a fresh start. We see that time and again. That's the Supreme Court says. That's the code. It's a fresh start. People, and I think Judge Simon, in his opinion, said, you know, he stiffed the fund. This is the word he used.
He still gets a fresh start without $10,000 tacked on to it in addition.
Yeah, but that's not so much a reward. Remember, the purpose of the punitive damages, that's not in order to reward the debtor in this case for his cost. It's to punish the defendant International for their actions and what they did. And both Judge Simon and Judge Klingenberger found those actions to be egregious, noncompliant. They made the requisite findings to substantiate. And $10,000, although it's a lot of money, it's a lot less than we see in many other punitive
cases. What was the amount
cases.
Of the arrearage to the his delinquency to the pension fund contribution?
I want to say their judgment was somewhere in the neighborhood of $107,000, but that included that was everything. I think the delinquent contributions were right around $52,000, roughly. So that was the delinquency. And I think we have to look at this case in the context. International wants to keep framing this as recoupment of overpayments, and this court's decision in Northcutt. Well, we're at an entirely different procedural posture in this case. We're no longer operating under the contract. We have a judgment, a default judgment, by the way, on this personal guarantee. It's been reduced to judgment. The contract, as far as it concerns Mr. Radcliffe, it's no longer executory. He's done everything he's done. He's retired. The only executory part is left on the behalf of the fund, and they have to pay him his pension benefits. Now, we can go through the core analysis out of the Third Circuit and so forth, but I think telltale is the revision or the addition to the statute, 1056. When we have a judgment like we do here, the statute is plain because the fund wants the court to believe that this wasn't an assignment or an alienation. But the first sentence of 1056D4 reads as follows. The prohibition on alienation shall not apply to any offset. Well, the only time we can have an offset is when we have mutual debts. The only mutual debt that Mr. Radcliffe could have had was with the fund. Clearly, this is an alienation. It's an assignment. By definition, under the statute, it is. Because we have that alienation, we need an exemption. That's what D4 talks about. When we have a judgment, the amount that the participant is ordered or required to pay, you can be exempt from the anti-alienation if, but only if, the order or requirement to pay arises under a judgment of conviction, number one, for a crime involving the plan, or under a civil judgment, that's the part we have to hear, of part four of this subtitle. And the judgment expressly provides for the offset. It has to be in the judgment. And the reason, at least from the history, it would appear that it was set up this way in response to, well, the Guidry decision from the Supreme Court and the Core decision, where they said, look, we have some cases out there where some people are actually defrauding these funds, and based on this language in the statute, there may not be a right of offset. So what we're going to do is we're going to make a policy decision. Congress made this policy decision. If you stiff the fund in such a way that you breach a fiduciary duty, then you're not going to get your pension benefits until such time as we can offset them and get them back from you. They say that's not fair. Congress has made the determination, if you just can't pay, because we don't know what the underlying basis for the failure to pay was. Yes, he signed a personal guarantee that said, I will pay these funds back to you. But you can envision many situations. For instance, the secretary embezzles funds, falsifies documents, someone responsible for your bookkeeping while you're out in the field. Perhaps it's your niece, perhaps it's your wife, perhaps it's someone you want to protect. The fund comes to you and says, you owe these, your company owes these, you're delinquent. You say, you know what? I need to protect this person. I'm going to personally guarantee it. That's just a regular old debt. And Congress has made the determination that in that circumstance, guess what? You can't offset. That's an alienation or an assignment that we are not going to permit. And I think in that
what
same...
What was the business entity that owed those delinquent?
Closely held. It was a closely held corporation. It was, and he had a partner. You know, his partner isn't part of this, but he signed a personal guarantee also.
If the personal guarantee that was signed by Radcliffe had explicitly provided that reimbursement could be obtained by withholding pension payments until the amount owed was repaid, is it your contention that under Northcutt, that contractual right could not be enforced simply because it didn't involve an overpayment?
Two reasons. Because it wasn't an overpayment, or a recoupment of an overpayment. Northcutt has no persuasive or controlling authority in this particular case. And number two, because we have a judgment. Don't forget, we have a judgment here. We have a default judgment. We're way past the operation of the contract. This is not a party. This is not the fund suing pursuant to the contract. That's long gone. That's done and disposed with. They have their judgment. Their judgment was you owe this debt. There was no breach of fiduciary duty or crime or anything else that would permit an exception to the anti-assignment clause of 1060-56D4.
I'm not sure that was an answer to what Judge Rovner, asked. I mean, it's simply, if he had signed with that kind of explicit language a waiver, would that be permissible then to not seek a relief from the bankruptcy court?
Under the facts of this case?
Sure.
I don't think so.
She asked a hypothetical question.
I don't think so. Hypothetically, absent a judgment, perhaps. I would have to look at it a little further. But I'm not aware of any case where they said just voluntary assignment, absent one of these exceptions, is permissible. It may be a contract.
You might be right. It just seems to me that you ought to be able to waive that if you enter a knowingly and voluntary waiver of your right to receive your pension or assign your pension benefits to the benefit of somebody else. That's what, in effect, you'd be doing.
It would be going farther than the contract permitted. I'm not going to stand here and say that no, you couldn't waive that, but we know in this case that didn't happen. If you have no further questions, I would like the court to affirm the decision of the district court and the underlying bankruptcy court decision, finding that, yes, there was a violation of the automatic stay, which it seems to me the fund almost admits at this point, and secondly, that they had no right to relief from stay because they didn't meet the statutory requirements to do so.
Thank you, counsel. You have 1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, the court is focused on the issue in Kennedy. Kennedy held that a waiver is not a redirection of money to the plan. I think that's core, cuts away with the assumption here that there was an assignment or alienation. D4 can be read to allow remedies by the Department of Labor or participant, even if the plan refuses to do so. The example of the secretary falsifying records is actually one of the problems here. If that secretary is not a fiduciary, we can't get the money. As far as fiduciary breach is concerned, there is a brand new decision in U.S. v. Jackson out of the Fourth Circuit, 524 F3rd, 532, page 534, that holds this situation would be a fiduciary breach. Most importantly, this case is not about 362A7. This case is about 362A6 and the holding that the November letter alone was a threat or an attempt to collect the judgment. That letter has statutory content. We have to tell him that if he doesn't appeal, it's final under the plan. We did. We can't. There's no reason that what the DOL tells us to say should becomes a violation of the bankruptcy code. The timing issue does not change, the timing of a formal motion does not change that basic conclusion. And the ultimate problem here is if the district court is right, how do we ever recover a small fiduciary breach when we can't get attorney's fees? They're all gone.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.